Welcome to the Exam Room. I'm your host, Brian Vartabedian. In this episode, I had the chance to catch up with Dr. Victor Montori from the Mayo Clinic. He's the author of Why We Revolt, A Patient Revolution for Careful and Kind Care. Something of a manifesto, his book details all that's wrong with what he calls industrial healthcare. As a field driven by protocols and algorithms, both patients and clinicians are feeling increasingly empty and uncared for. Montori's passion and vision for a return to our roots of care really comes through in our discussion. And I think the episode will leave you with more questions than answers, which I consider a success. I hope you enjoy it.
For most consumers, the search for a healthcare provider is a frustrating maze of bewildering choices and unanswered questions. And they really want to hear what other patients have to say in order to make a decision with confidence.
With Loyal's Empower solution, you have the tools to do just that. Empower your patients, the patient, and provide a solution, maximizing star ratings while introducing deeper insights into what patients really are saying about their experience.
You could sort, approve, and publish patient reviews of physicians, services, and even practices using some of the intelligent features like auto-approval and syntax highlighting.
To learn more, visit them online at loyalhealth.com.
Welcome to the Exam Room, Dr. Montori. Your book is Why We Revolt, A Patient Revolution for Patient and Kind Care. This is really kind of a manifesto that rails against the emerging concept of industrialized medicine and the resulting depersonalization of healthcare. So what led you to write this book, Victor?
Thanks, Brian. I didn't want to write this book. I wanted to write a book about our research. We had been doing work on patient-centered care, shared decision-making, and minimally disruptive medicine for the last decade or so. And I thought it would be nice to summarize what we had learned in the book. But every time I sat down to write that book down, this book tried to come out. And it was pretty clear that describing my research was not as important to me than trying to put it in one place why I felt that the environment in which I was, in which I am working, which we are working, and the environment in which we are caring for patients no longer matches, I think, what we all imagine patient care is about. And I stopped, and eventually, you know, I basically quit trying to write the book about my research. And when I did that, this thing came out in a hurry.
So this is something that just had to come out of you, I guess. You felt so passionate about it. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, you hear other people talk about this sort of thing, and you think, oh, they're just being cute about it. But I frankly, the thing, there are some chapters there that came out you know, in one sitting, with very minimal effort. And so it really was something that needed, that had some urgency to it, even though it took me like 4 years to write it.
So you and I don't know if you remember, we were on a panel about 8 or 10 years ago in Paris.
Yes.
I remember that.
Yes.
At Doctors 2.0, I think. And at
yes.
that time, I would have to say that I think you were probably doing minimally disruptive medicine at that point, but you really weren't advocating for a revolution as you suggest in the book. What happened with you personally? What is there anything that's driven you personally to advocate for such a bold restructuring in the way we deliver care?
Yeah, I don't. So there is no one event. I think, you know, like, I guess like cancer, right? You get the two hit theory, you know, they have to have two bad things happen to you. But no, nothing really bad happened. I think that we have experienced a ongoing and continued deterioration in what we imagine patient care to be. And so I work at Mayo Clinic, and of course, what I say does not represent the views of my employer. But, you know, Mayo has one of the most, I think, strongest patient-centered cultures in healthcare. And what you see here, and you start seeing it everywhere else, and when we start doing research in primary care across the country, we start visiting places and you see it there, you start recognizing the pattern. And the pattern was of a form of industrialized healthcare in which CEOs, like in other corporations, in other industries, begin to have a lot of importance, where standardization and lean and other things that you see in manufacturing begin to run the day, where the standards begin to require clinicians to see patients as members of a group and begin to care for patients as the care that is necessary for patients like them, right, than for each one of them, where we need to accelerate the practice because we got to get better access and throughput, where we have to document mostly for billing, right, than to communicate with ourselves or our colleagues or our patients. So start seeing this as a pattern. So what is this, just poor execution, or is this really responding to a different vision of what care needs to be? And I think it eventually became clear that this is not poor execution. This is excellent execution when you want to become a very functional, very efficient, very sustainable healthcare industry. And so, okay, what are the downsides of doing that? And what the downsides are is what we're seeing is that people at the front lines, patients, on the one hand, becoming overwhelmed with the work transferred to them and receiving care almost by accident, and clinicians feeling demoralized and looking for meaning in mission trips to Haiti, right, and finding meaning in one of the most extraordinary, one of the extraordinary careers one can have, which is to be a physician.
You talked about this issue of being lean and being efficient. I mean, clearly, you even concede in the book that we have to be efficient in order to deliver care that's to be sustainable, right? I mean, there's some balance here, right, that we do have to operate in an efficient way. And so where's the balance between what you describe and why we revolt and this process-driven drive that we're seeing?
Yeah. So one of the key things that we try to convey in Why We Revolt is that everyone is doing their job. Everyone is doing what is expected of them. So if you're going to take care of precious dollars, you know, that are allocated to healthcare, you better be, you know, efficient, not wasteful, and because that's going to be the key for your sustainability and your innovation, no question. But that follows your mission. It doesn't lead your mission. And the example I give, which is, I don't use it in the book, but I use it in my presentations, which is a bit ridiculous. But imagine you're working with Doctors Without Borders and you go to a refugee camp outside of Syria. You're not going to do fundraising in the refugee camp, right? You're not going to go and see, okay, well, I'm not going to take care of these guys because I cannot make enough money taking care of these guys. No, you take care of whoever you find there in the way you can make it. And you have somebody in your back office doing, you know, back at home in the US or wherever, doing the fundraising and getting the resources you need so you can continue to take care of people at the front line. But you just walk into any campus of any medical center in the United States, and what you see is that there will be more mission where the money is. So there'll be, you know, you're orthopedic or you're a gastroenterologist or you're a cardiologist and you do procedures, and there's been traditionally more money going there. You'll see big centers, you know, focus on that. And you won't see a big center focus on social work or rehabilitation or mental health or these sorts of things that are also quite prevalent, but it's just, you know, have not been favored by the reimbursement. And so you'll see less investment there, even though the mission perhaps is even greater. So there's been a flip between mission and the means to accomplish it. You know, the idea of no money, no mission subverted into being, you know, more mission where there's more money. And again, you wouldn't be looking for more money in the refugee camp.
So you're saying we kind of have to separate mission from business operations, right, and keep them separated on some level?
No, I think it's a little further than that. It's the idea that in order to make our financial targets, we slowly but surely begin to focus our mission where we can have a better financial performance. And the problem of focusing our mission where we can get a better financial performance is that that is not the logic of care, it's the logic of business. And we cannot let the logic of business run care. The logic of business have to follow where the care decisions go. So if you're running a healthcare organization and your goal is, for instance, to provide, to care for people in a way that meets their needs and so forth, your back office people have to support you with the means to achieve that. They should not tell you who you should see and how fast you should see them and so forth to make the money work. And I think there has to be a close relationship, and it has to be disciplined, because again, otherwise we'll be wasting. But what I propose in the book is not that we should be efficient, but that we should be elegant, that we should be able to do what we are here to do without waste and without haste. But we should not cut on what we have to do, because that will be financially expeditious.
So the world, or the medical world, has gone quality crazy. Every institution you go in the United States, you see that there's this real focus on quality and process. Is this a good thing for patients, or is it just another example of tyranny of the metrics?
Depends. I think that if you just go to my home country in Peru and visit any hospital, you realize the critical importance of quality and safety. Mm-hmm. You can't be going to a place like that and basically waving to your family as if you are about to play Russian roulette, you know, with your life, and you may not come out. So I think there is a critical need to maintain the gains that have been achieved in safety and to improve the reliability of our processes. But there's a threshold for those sorts of activities, a setup by which when patient and clinician, or the patient and clinical teams, come together to make decisions or to care, there the process of standardization, quality, safety, et cetera, has to take a step back and create a space for care to occur that actually meets where this patient is, that makes intellectual, emotional, and practical sense for this person. And so there, variability should be welcome. But once we decide, for instance, to do an endoscopy, gosh, you've got to have an endoscope that is clean, an endoscopist mm-hmm. that is trained, and you know that takes the necessary looks, that draws the necessary biopsies, and the pathologist that looks, you know, gets the necessary cuts. And that part of the process has to be, you know, as high quality, as standardized, as improved, and as safe as you can make it. The problem is when we keep going and we take patients as if they were, we stop seeing them in high definition and begin to see them, for instance, as a lab test, or see them as a biopsy, or a statistic in population health, or see them too fast where we don't notice who they are.
The blur, right? Yeah, the blur of patients. Right.
Exactly. So we blur them, and there, by not noticing who they are, we can easily standardize their care. And so when we standardize their care, sometimes we undercare for them, sometimes we overcare for them, and sometimes we get it just right. And it's so those moments where we just get it done just right that patients celebrate. And I think those are the moments that inhibit us from changing the system as a whole, because we're afraid that we may lose those miracle moments.
This is a quote from Why We Revolt. Measurement of the outcomes of care is in its infancy. The first generation measures are easy to assess, but are largely disconnected from the quality of care patients experience. So as I was reading through the book, I was thinking about the modern move toward patient experience and press mm-hmm. Gini scores, and we're so driven by these metrics. I think this conversation is good, but do you think it misses the mark? Is this whole movement a positive thing?
Again, if it was in the context of patient care, I think it's very positive. The problem is it becomes industrialized very quickly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yes, of course, having a pleasant, careful experience where you're seen by, so you show up and people know who you are and know you, and there's a human personal connection. It's different than, oh, my scores on parking satisfaction are low. I can make them higher by asking people if they found the parking spot right away, because then people give me a higher score. Then it's fake. It is a check-the-box approach. It is not authentic. So I think we need, it's when we massify, when we industrialize these things, that then they lose connection to the reality of things. There's a great article, I wish I could quote it, that a CEO from a startup in Minneapolis published, that she went to one of these state-of-the-art facilities that was all about patient experience, and she was received by a hostess who had an iPad and collected this information. But she had to run away from the place because, A, the information she was collecting on her flashy iPad was already known to the practice from previous data collections. She was put in a nice little pod where there was no music, and she was waiting, but she didn't feel that she was this weight seemed to have no explanation. There was no one else around her. She felt that her time was being wasted. So even though they were making it all very pleasant and elegant, that almost spa-like feeling that should give you high scores on patient experience, she did not feel recognized, seen, or cared for. And she was there for 15, 20 minutes, and then she decided to leave. So we have to be careful that when we do, when we are trying, when somebody's sick or is at risk of becoming sick, our response should be care. It should not be to provide care or to give a nice experience, or it should be to care. And then around the experience of care, we should have quality and safety procedures and all those other things. And the experience of care should be an outcome, should be the result of our caring, should not be something that we enhance of its own, whether or not we care for the patient. So it's this disconnect stuff that you would maybe make sense if you're running a shop or a restaurant. But the whole underlying message of the book, or maybe like kind of its hidden agenda, is I don't believe in my heart of hearts that healthcare should be conceptualized like an industry, should not be equated to any other service. I think it should be its own special thing, like parenting. You know, mm-hmm. Where's your quality improvement efforts on your parenting, and where are your standards in parenting, and where's your reliability? Yeah. I mean, I have three boys, right? The three of them are completely different. Do I have a reliability problem? I don't think so. I'm actually quite proud that the three of them are different.
So I have a colleague who works in a hospital, and the administrators found some evidence that when doctors lean forward, they appear more empathic. And so they went on a mission to make all the doctors lean forward when they're interviewing patients. And so you had all these angry, bitter doctors leaning forward. And it's just this whole point of trying to game the system for endpoint numbers rather than providing that care that you discuss.
Well, so the other thing that highlights is the administrators went on a mission to get the clinicians to lean forward. And that what that describes is something that I describe in the book as the clinician and the patient as mere workers on the factory floor of this industry, in which they co-produce this care that they have to deliver. And then they show what they've made together. They show it to the payer and say, hey, is this of enough value for you? Would you pay for this? Mm-hmm. And the patient is not the person to which we are accountable to. No, patient and clinician are both accountable to the payer. And if the patient doesn't do their part, it's because they're not empowered, they're not activated, we need to activate them, or they don't have skin in the game, so we need to use incentives or punishment. What is that, right? I mean, the point is, we shouldn't be accountable to the payer, we should be accountable to the patient. And the clinician, administration, payers, we should all be asking the patients, are we meeting your needs? But that's not the game we're playing now. It's a completely different game in which patients and clinicians are employees, and they must produce for the payer satisfaction of value. That's no longer patient care. That's industrial healthcare, and I think we should not tolerate that.
So you described that linking compensation to the number of procedures or even the quality of care, as we're discussing here, introduces a level of bias against careful and kind care. What do you mean by this?
The reason incentives are used is because every human seems to be wired to respond to that. I think the more externally motivated you are, the more likely you are to respond to this. I'm, for instance, very susceptible to this. I love attention. I love praise. You know, this mm-hmm. This interview is doing wonders to my ego, right? And I think I blame the nuns from my school back in Peru who every quarter publish all the grades from all the kids in my class. So you could see who was about the bottom of the class, who was at the top and so forth. So it was not the glory and the pleasure of learning. It was reputation scores, right? And so that's my upbringing. So I know that these things can really make you feel bad if you don't achieve the mark and you really want to work to achieve the mark. Add to that money, and boy, that's a really powerful behavior modification strategy. And so if you are going to be paid to achieve a particular target, and the targets are, as you read before, in their infancy, if they're very rudimentary in what they mean by quality or what they mean by performance, then you're going to find a way of making that mark whether or not the patient is cared for properly. And there's a great article in the Health Foundation newsletter in the UK of a woman who goes to her primary care doctor with a knee problem. the doctor refers this woman to an orthopedic surgeon who has a wonderful shared decision-making interaction with this woman. They decide together to get the surgery done. The patient goes in. After 2 days, she is discharged from the hospital, making the metric for length of stay for an uncomplicated knee procedure. Mm-hmm. And she goes home. But she's completely miserable at home because she's in a two-level house. She cannot really go up and down the stairs. She has no support. And when they went back and look at her chart, she actually never got conservative measures for that knee. And the clinician, the primary clinician, thought this was a different lady where they had already tried conservative measures. And that's why she referred her quickly to the surgeon. So you could have quality metrics that will all be satisfied. The whole system looks like it did great, but the patient actually did not need any of it. And certainly at the end was not ready to live with the consequences of the surgery, given that she lived alone in a house that was not ready for that. So we need to see the whole person. And to the extent that our quality metrics or other metrics force us to see a part of it or just our performance, we lose focus on whether this patient will be better off because of what we do. In that way, it corrupts careful care, which is care that actually is evidence-based and is more likely to do more good than harm.
So is there any way we can incent doctors to deliver the kind of care that you describe and why we revolt? Is there a way to do that? Or does it have to come from our heart, really?
The intention of the book is to prevent you from asking that question again, because we tried to eliminate, right? So we shouldn't have some external power incenting professionals to do the right thing. And certainly we don't incent people to provide care. You know, care is already a verb, right? So we shouldn't be providing care as if it was a box or delivering care if it's, you know, as a parcel. We should just care. Mm-hmm. Right. And we are clinicians. We're not providers. And the nurses, the nurse practitioners, we're all clinicians. We have the privilege of the bedside. And what we do at the bedside is we care. And if there are incentives at play, that means somebody with more power than you is telling you how to behave professionally. And professionals, by definition, are people who worry about the downstream consequences of their actions. But once somebody tells you what to do, the responsibility for the downstream consequences of your actions are transferred elsewhere. So the administration made me do it is no longer a professional behavior. So we become deprofessionalized. And I think that's, to some extent, contributing to this epidemic of burnout. Mm-hmm. So now, I also am not naive. When clinicians didn't have these checks and balances and quality and all these other things, we did terrible things to people. So in other words, we know that as professionals, we have fallen short in the past. And I don't want to go back to the situation where the clinicians, physicians in particular, were kings or queens, but mostly kings, and they were able to call all the shots. But I do want a system in which we respect the professionalism of clinicians. We respect the time, attention, and energy and expertise of patients. And we create a space for them to figure out what is right while we monitor with increasingly smart ways how well we're doing for that patient. And we hold ourselves, the clinician, the system, everything, everyone, accountable to the patient. But not to a payer, not to an employer, not to someone whose life is not at stake.
Hey, everybody, this is Reed Smith.
And this is Chris Boyer.
And we are co-hosts on a show called Touchpoint, which is a podcast that's dedicated to the discussions on digital marketing and online patient engagement strategies, not only for just hospitals, but health systems and physician practices.
In every episode, we'll dive deep into a variety of topics on digital tools, solutions, strategies, and other things that are impacting the healthcare industry today.
And while you listen to this show, we would certainly love you to check out ours.
All you have to do is swing on over to touchpoint.health for more information, and also some of the other shows that are featured on the Touchpoint Media Network.
So, Victor, you talk about the patient revolution as patients driving the revolution. When you just touched upon burnout, I see this burnout issue as just a huge issue. If you look at the editorial last week from the New England Journal of Medicine, Abigail Zuger, one of the noted HIV doctors from, I think, the Brigham and Women, basically discussed her exit from medicine and discussed who was going to take over for her patients. And she sarcastically said, the algorithm will do it. Two suicides at NYU last week, within 5 days of a trainee and a medical student. I mean, this is truly an epidemic. What's behind this? What's really behind this epidemic of burnout, which I'm really just beginning to recognize, honestly?
Yeah. So it's very hard to understand. It's very hard to understand. I think we can do well by recognizing what is contributing to this. Historically, I think that being a clinician has been very hard. Historically, it's always been very hard. You are confronted with people's darkest moments. Moments of incredible anguish that, of course, remind you of your own mortality and your own limitations, and that make the usual problems of daily life that other people experience seem completely trivial, which makes it hard for you to talk about what you experience with anyone. I mean, this, I think, to some extent has contributed to other epidemics before affecting the health profession, including addictions and divorces and so forth. So this burnout thing is the latest, I think, a characterization of what has been. I mean, if one looks at the past, there's always been a description of how addiction and self-harm and divorce and other kind of problems of relationships have affected the clinicians for a long time. I think what's added to that now is that at least you had the satisfaction of caring for people. And what has many forms of the practice today, particularly those forms that are not associated with fixing. For instance, I'm a diabetes doctor, right? And so many primary care clinicians now mostly see chronic illness. There is no fixing, really. You're sort of working with people as they go through their life, and you're trying to get them further, and you're trying to get them healthier. There is no Christmas card, thank you for saving my life sort of thing for many people like us. Mm-hmm. So the satisfactions are very, very intrinsic. And on top of that, now add the fact that you're getting feedback that you're a terrible person, you're a terrible doctor, you don't take care of people well because here are your metrics. No, you're making excuses now for why your metrics are not good. No, your patients are not that different. Don't argue with the data. You need to do better. No, don't be authentic. You know, you suck as a person. You need to lean forward, right? Because otherwise people don't think you're friendly, right? Yeah. Right? So there's a lot of, and so, and you know, and the deprofessionalization, the notion that you're there to serve the master, but the master that you thought you were going to serve, which was the patient, is actually not the real one. I think all of these things are making important contributions to change the nature of what being a clinician is. And some people are suffering through the adaptation or the change in their identity. And some people like me think that perhaps we shouldn't accept that change in identity. And you started this question by saying, you know, why are we saying the patient should take the lead? And it's because everywhere I go, Brian, and I talk about these things, the first question I hear from clinicians is, we don't have the time. We cannot change anything. We just have to do what we have to do. So there's a learned helplessness, a feature or a symptom of an abuse victim that comes from people whose patients believe are in charge. So the patients believe the doctors are in charge, but the doctors feel completely powerless. And so that's incredible.
Yeah.
And so if we wait for clinicians to take over and change the system, I think we're going to wait for a long time. I think if citizens recognize that they're not getting what they think they're getting in healthcare, that what they're getting is really to contribute to otherwise enormous profits in a healthcare industry, then I think they're going to revolt. And I think just like in the civil rights movement, you know, remember that picture they have of the Selma, you know, march, and you see Martin Luther King, and you see people on the front line, you know, locking arms. Some of them are black, but some of them are white. And I think the same thing will happen here, is that citizens will revolt, but I think people like you and I will join very quickly because we don't find that this system is what we sign up for.
And as you suggest in Why We Revolt, you say that the dehumanization of clinicians makes them expendable and interchangeable like light bulbs. Light bulbs that, as the system is finding out, can burn out. Cruelty incites cruelty. I thought that was really amazing.
Yeah, I think that's true. Just as we blur the patient so we can use standards and we can be efficient about them and we can assess the quality of our work, you know, what the A1C is for all our diabetics regarding of their circumstance, I think the same thing happens with clinicians, you know, that we give them 15-minute or 20-minute or 25-minute appointment slots as if all the slots were the same, as if all clinicians had the same skills. We give them the same tools to do the work, and we expect the same output from all of them. Well, and if you talk to people about this form of reliability, they will tell you that you no longer care who your pilot is on the plane.
Right.
And as I tell in the book the story, you know, yeah, so at one point you don't care who the pilot is, the pilot doesn't care who the passengers are, and that's what we want for care.
I'm not sure about that. We want to make the healthcare industry just like the airline industry, right? I mean, I hear that analogy all the time you discuss in the book.
Yeah, and like every analogy, at some point it breaks down. And I think that point was exceeded a long time ago.
You talk about your experience in Why We Revolt in Peru, and you contrast your Peruvian experience with that of being at the Mayo Clinic or being here. Are there cultural differences? I see the world from inside the U.S., and are there real cultural differences in the revolution? Shouldn't we be leading the way? Aren't we the most progressive in the U.S.?
I think that's an interesting question. So one of the surprises I've had with the book is how well it's done outside the U.S. Because it's clearly a U.S.-centric book, mm-hmm. right? But there's an Italian translation that is coming through. There's a Spanish translation that's coming through. There's a Danish researcher who's written me that they're developing a research program around some of the ideas of the book. So the question is, why is it? And there's an Australian professor who just sent me a note today with some poems that he's written in response to the book. So the question is, why is this resonating in systems that are, for instance, publicly funded, where the greed topic that I bring up in the book as a major driver of the system that we have is supposedly less at play? And what I notice is that some aspects of the systems that evolve to try to do more with less have the effect of burdening patients, of converting them into blurry visions of themselves, burning through clinicians. So in other words, the consequences of efficiencies, either to optimize greedy profits or to make sure that we can care to the same patients and to the same degree with shrinking budgets, which is what's happening, for instance, in Europe with austerity measures. They're shrinking the budgets and they're trying to get the same care out of the system. Well, so you're having a burnout workforce. You have patients that feel that they're not cared for. So the consequences of trying to do the same with less seem to be the same. So that's for the commonality. And then what seems to be different across different places is their notion of solidarity and caring for each other. I think, for instance, the NHS in the UK comes forward in an island after a war, mm-hmm. right? So there's a particular context in which, okay, we're here together. What can we do to come out of this better? Well, let's develop a national health service. The Canadian effort has its own context. The U.S. effort is kind of weird, right? It's catching us. This crisis is catching us at a time where society is atomized, where we care about ourselves, maybe our family, and that's about it. Our degree of solidarity only comes out in case of disasters, right? So if there's a big tornado or hurricane or flooding, we help each other. We donate to the Red Cross. When it's over, we're done. We're going back to our home theaters. We're going back to our own little experiences for ourselves and nothing else. And so what is the system of care in the United States that makes sense with the way society is evolving in the United States? That's actually really hard to answer. And the other difference I think culturally is appropriate is that, and I think this is why talking a lot about Peru in the book makes sense, is that at least in Peru, I could understand what I was seeing as the consequence of scarcity, mm-hmm. as a consequence of poverty. We didn't have the resources. So the budget was constrained there because the country was poor. What is our excuse here?
Right. So, Victor, when I was reading this book, I kind of felt powerless on some level. I was empowered on one hand. On the other hand, I kind of felt like, what can I specifically do? I feel like this problem is so deeply ingrained into the healthcare system that I've been brought into. Where does change really start? And what can I do as a provider? If you were advising me or a group of young providers, what can we do to kind of initiate what you discuss and why we revolt?
Okay, so the first thing is change the language. I sincerely feel that's a very strong first step. It's, first of all, it's free. You can stop saying providers, for instance, right now, and that would just make a big change. But the other thing that it does is it changes the conversation. Let's not talk about access and throughput and efficiency. Let's talk about care and elegance. Let's talk about love. Let's talk about solidarity. Let's go to the board meetings and talk about how might we care better for patients? How might we love, demonstrate our love for patients in this way or that way? Let's start comparing our policies on the basis of that language. And I think that will be a very powerful first step. I've had an opportunity to be at a hospital in Spain where I brought that up to their CFO and CEO, and they were talking about a particular program. And it was interesting because at some point they all shut up. And so I interjected, said, so what's happening? And they were trying to explain the problem they had, but they didn't have they didn't want to use the economic language to describe, and they were looking for an alternative language and they were struggling. And I think that using a language of care would drive different decisions than if we use a language of industry and business. So I would think that would be a first easy step, and it would be very, very subversive. When I wrote the book, remember, I started writing the book 2013. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff that we have now with the politics of Trump and all these other things was not in the foreground. I think for me to say now how important words are has been emphasized, but we've seen in the political sphere and how words have gained or lost meaning. Like, for instance, the word lie has, I think, in my mind, completely lost its meaning, or at least its force. So that I think is an important aspect because it has changed the language. And the second thing is, think about this as a long-term adventure. In the book, I have a chapter called Cathedrals, and there are a number of reasons I wrote that chapter, but one of them is the fact that when towns wanted to demonstrate what was important to them, they built these cathedrals, and it took generations, and the person that put the final touches on the finished cathedral was probably three or four generations downstream from the person that started, who never saw the cathedral finished. We're not used to projects like that, but perhaps this is one of them. Perhaps it will take multiple generations until we'll get the care system that actually cares. And if it's going to take that long, we better start.
So I have to pick up on this issue of what we call the people that deliver care to patients. You caught me saying, I think, provider. So what term do you like to use for what I do, what you do?
So you just asked me, how do you call the people that deliver care? So I would switch that to, how do we call people?
Oh my gosh, I get caught again. And,
yes, hard. It's hard. It's actually
I've been
really
brainwashed.
Hard. So
I've been brainwashed.
I like there you go. So I think I would call them clinicians. So clinicians comes from a root that means bed. And the same root for clinical and other things. And so if you're at the bedside, or the bedside in quotes, if I may, and you're there to care, you're not there to do anything else, you're there to care, you're a clinician. You could be a therapist, you could be a pharmacist, you could be a physician, you could be a nurse practitioner, physician assistant. You can be anyone who's there to care at the bedside is a clinician. And to me, that's a generic term. Within clinicians, you can find physicians, mm-hmm. you can find therapists, nurses, pharmacists, etc. People say, well, why do you call the secretary of the unit? Well, you call her medical secretary of the unit. And if the medical secretary of the unit actually has responsibilities to care for the patients, in that role, there are clinicians as well. And I think that that's generic enough, but it highlights that the role is not to serve a particular industrial job. Their role is to care, and also highlights that the position, and the position is at the bedside. And again, it may be at the desk side in the outpatient setting or whatever, but that is a position of privilege. Not everyone in society is given access to that moment where patient, you know, bows their head, fills their eyes with tears, and tells you their deepest secret and how that is eating them inside and causing them struggle and pain. That being there is a privilege. It's something that only a few of us have been given that role in society to play, to be there, to care. We should be honored, proud, and delighted and refreshed at the end of the day that we have this luck and we come back for more the next day. Compare that to the feeling of a provider who delivers care, who is judged to the value of that care and comes home to the disgusting situation of having to interact with their family and thinking about ending their career, if not ending their life. You know, that's what industrial healthcare is causing. I want patient care in which clinicians care at the bedside.
Certainly, the rise of industrialized healthcare has had, you know, made me forget that it really is a privilege to provide care to patients. And it's clear from this interview that I have to look after my language, right? Victor, thank you. You've been very kind. How do people find out more about the revolution and your nonprofit?
Yeah, so we have a website, patientrevolution.org. And in that website, patientrevolution.org, there's a link to the book itself, Why We Revolt, and there's an opportunity to not only contribute to what we're trying to do, but also an opportunity to draw from the tools and approaches that we have so that anybody can do locally a few exercises to begin to start a conversation that will turn away from industrial healthcare and turn towards careful and kind care for all.
The book is Why We Revolt. The author is Dr. Victor Monturi, a passionate ambassador for change, and I might add, a passionate advocate for both patients and clinicians. Thank you, Dr. Monturi.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
This show is made possible in part by the Social Health Institute. Through research and partnerships with healthcare organizations around the country, the Social Health Institute explores new and innovative ways for hospitals, healthcare organizations, to develop and enhance their social media and digital marketing strategy. To learn more about the Social Health Institute, visit them online at socialhealthinstitute.com. That's socialhealthinstitute.com.
Thank you for joining us in the exam room. If you like what you heard here, please rate the program, review us, or let folks know about us. And if you have any really cool ideas that you'd like discussed here, please feel free to let us know. This has been a Touchpoint Media production. To learn more about this show and others like it, please visit us online at touchpoint.health.